From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle. Two fatal shootings by law enforcement officers are making headlines in Southern California. We talk through both incidents with police experts and later how ads portray gender roles. British authorities have banned harmful gender stereotypes from advertisements. We want to hear from you. Would a similar ban do us good here in America? All that plus the findings of an audit at the Cal State University system on Air Talk. First, this news. Good morning. It's Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes, in as I have been all week for Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for joining us. A lot to get to on the show today. Film Week coming your way at 11. Today on Air Talk, we'll be talking about an audit of the Cal State University system, and coming up a little bit later, a discussion of gender roles in advertisements. But first, a discussion of fatal shootings that have been back in the news in Southern California, two that have made headlines involving sworn law enforcement officers. First, on June 6th, two L.A. County sheriff's deputies opened fire on a man under investigation on possible weapons charges. The deputies fired 34 shots into a vehicle that 24-year-old Ryan Twyman was driving. Just this week, the sheriff's department released video footage showing that incident. In video narration, the department says Twyman was using the vehicle as a weapon against the deputies. Twyman's family this week called his death murder. And then there was last week's shooting inside a Corona Costco. Off-duty LAPD officer identified this week as Salvador Sanchez shot dead 32-year-old Kenneth French, a man said by a family attorney to be nonverbal and intellectually disabled. KPCC public safety reporter Frank Stoltz has been keeping tabs on both incidents and joins us now. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Kyle, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us. So let's start with the 34 rounds that L.A. County Sheriff's deputies fired into the vehicle that 24-year-old Ryan Twyman was driving. There was video footage that came out earlier this week. What did we learn from that footage? What did it show that happened?
Well, the release of the video footage, to begin with, is extraordinary because the Sheriff's Department does not have body cams. It is not in the habit of releasing this type of material this early. We see it all the time from the LAPD. All street officers at the LAPD have body cams. They have a policy where they release the video within 45 days of these kinds of incidents. So this release is notable to begin with. This midnight release, it was released by the Sheriff's Department in a 12:21 a.m. Release. And this surveillance camera that is situated above this parking lot in an apartment complex in Willowbrook. And it is narrated by a commander with the department. And they are attempting, according to the sheriff yesterday told me, they're attempting to dispel rumors because there were all sorts of rumors about him being, you know, shot in the head and execution style and all of this business. What we see, of course, is Ryan Twyman in a car. These two deputies approach, one of them from the back right.
And the car is parked in a parking lot, like in an apartment building.
Right. Head in. And so when the deputy opens the door and begins to interact with him, according to the department, Twyman, starts the car and begins to back up.
As the Kia reversed, the passenger side deputy was struck with the open rear passenger door and pushed into the center of the parking lot as he attempted to maintain his balance to avoid being knocked down and run over. At that time, both deputies fired their service pistols at Mr. Twyman in order to stop the vehicle from seriously injuring the passenger deputy.
What's interesting here is Commander Tardy is describing a situation where there was a deadly threat to the officer, the deputy. Both the LAPD and the Sheriff's Department a few years ago decided that cars alone could not be considered deadly threats. In other words, they changed their policies to say, look, you need to get out of the way of a vehicle and then determine what to do. The fear being that if you shot at a moving car, you would disable the driver and the car would then go careening out of control and be a threat to pedestrians.
Yeah, this was a change in policy, I believe, that took effect after, you know, KPCC has reported on this issue that there have been incidents involving shooting into moving cars, and there was an evolution on this policy within recent years on this.
And one of the key questions here is, to what extent was that door that was open? The deputy had opened the door. Twyman had begun to back up, and that back door hit that deputy. Apparently didn't really injure him, but the fear, as the commanders describing it, was that he could have fallen down and been run over by.
Yeah, didn't get injured. It looked like he was sort of like standing in the door frame or kind of hopping backward, and was able, the back rear passenger side door was open. It's kind of hard to picture if you haven't seen the video, but we do have,
which is on our website.
It is on our website, so you can look at it. And we have also brought on, to help us understand it, two police experts who have seen the video. Ed Obayashi is a deputy sheriff and legal advisor for the Plumas County Sheriff's Office and a use of force advisor for the California Association of Police Training Officers. Mr. Obayashi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What were your impressions of this video showing the interaction of the sheriff's deputies firing into this moving vehicle?
What we all have to understand is not the actual use of force standing alone by itself. You have to analyze and be aware of what these deputies knew prior to the use of force. In other words, what did they know about Mr. Twyman? They had more than enough reasonable belief in the information that had been provided to them by the gang detectives that Mr. Twyman was a violent, wanted felon, more than likely armed, because that was the warrant.
He was, and they had in fact served a search warrant where Twyman was not present at his residence and recovered a bunch of weapons.
Exactly. So they already know, before they even contact this individual, that he poses a serious threat to their safety, potentially, and the public. So upon contacting him, the officers used sound tactical approaches on the vehicle. The passenger deputy, as described and in the video, opens the rear door, so he has a tactical advantage being behind Mr. Twyman. The door opens, of course, as you described, and Mr. Twyman knew exactly what he was doing, based on what I'm saying. He consciously was trying to escape being arrested, and he didn't care whether or not he was going to run over this deputy. He knew the door was open, and his actions of reversing suddenly would obviously be an intentional act to harm the deputy and escape. Now, the deputy, as I pointed out earlier to your producer, if you look closely at this video, this deputy was, in fact, injured, so much so that when he was in the act of firing, you can clearly see he was grabbing or trying to feel with his left hand under his right arm in that area. That appears to me distinctively that he was struck with enough force by the door jamb that he had to grab his side in pain.
So there is reason to believe that the car was used as a weapon, as the sheriff's department says. I want to bring in another voice to sort of, you know, give impressions of this. And that's another retired sergeant with the L.A. Police Department, Cheryl Dorsey. She served for 20 years and worked her entire career in patrol and the gang unit in Operations South Bureau. Cheryl Dorsey, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
What are your impressions of the video that we saw?
Well, as I'm looking at it as a patrol supervisor, what I know is that deadly force is to be used as a last resort and not a first resort, and that officers don't get to create a situation to use deadly force. And so understanding that these officers knew exactly who Ryan was, they knew that he was involved in some felonious activity and had a record and had been on probation. And so why then would they not conduct an appropriate felony stop? Why would they approach him the way that they did? And I think if the deputy had stepped back from the car once it started to move, before he just started to shoot to stop him from fleeing, which is what criminals do. They don't want to go to jail. They run. We don't get to shoot them because they run. And so I have a problem with the tactics that led up to this shooting. And I'm so glad now that here in California we have AB 392 that's going to hopefully bring an end to this kind of unnecessarily using of deadly force as a first resort rather than a last resort.
Mr. Obayashi, I think it's important to think about how the officers approached the car, to your point that you have to think about what the officers knew when they made the approach about this person. Obviously, this is a person wanted on weapons charges, so there's some suspicion that there's a gun involved here. But also, you know, the officers approached this car parked head in a parking space from behind. One of the officers opens the door on the rear passenger side. I guess the possibility that raises itself in my mind is, you know, obviously he was trying to flee it's not obvious whether he was trying to flee police. It is possible that he was trying to flee police. There's also the possibility he was completely startled and had no idea who was approaching the back of his car. What do you think of that?
I would find that argument very difficult to make. He knew he was wanted. He saw these deputies. It's broad, pretty much, you know, got clear daylight. The officers are, deputies are identifying themselves. And I don't have a problem with the tactics because, you know, this is going to be what should have, could have, would have. Tactics are irrelevant when it comes to analysis of whether or not the use of force employed was justified or not. Other deputies could have employed different tactics. It doesn't matter. Everybody has to realize that this passenger deputy, was the victim of an immediate, serious, violent felony. In other words, assault with a deadly weapon. That car constituted, the act of using that car as in the manner was a serious, immediate, serious threat to the deputy. This all took place within a span of 2 seconds. The human brain does not react when I say react, it doesn't think about what to do, how to do, and when to do it at that time.
And law enforcement officers are often in the position of having to make those decisions. I want to make sure we have an opportunity to speak about the other shooting that's been making headlines. But I want to, before we move on, to just give Cheryl Dorsey a quick opportunity to sort of react to that. We sort of hear that initially your thoughts on this are different from Mr. Obayashi's. Former LAPD retired sergeant. How do you respond to that? I mean, this car in a very split second becomes, you know, in Mr. Obayashi's estimation, a deadly weapon, and an officer is justified in responding with force.
Well, what I can tell you is I did the job for 20 years in patrol in uniform, and I deal with people like Ryan all the time. And I understand that we are required to make split-second decisions, but we're also required to use a little common sense, our training, and we're required to use deadly force as a last resort and not a first resort. And listen, I understand great deference is given to what officers think. It's very difficult to be in the head of the officer and in the head of Ryan in terms of what they were thinking. And if you are able to articulate, as the commander did, very succinctly why this was useful and reasonable, then your word rules, because great deference is given to what police officers say.
All right. Cheryl Dorsey is a retired sergeant with the LAPD. Ed Obayashi, a deputy sheriff and legal advisor for the Plumas County Sheriff's Office, with us. And so is Frank Stoltz, KPCC public safety reporter. I want to briefly stick with this subject and talk about the shooting at the Corona Costco that happened last Friday night. An off-duty LAPD officer whose name we learned this week was involved. I mean, can you talk through what happened for those who haven't been up to speed on this? And if any new information has come out about this at this point?
Well, you know, according to police and the attorney for the police officer, the LAPD off-duty police officer who was involved, he was there shopping with his wife and 18-month-old child in his arms when Kenneth French allegedly violently attacked him. The family attorney acknowledges he pushed him. So we're unclear on exactly what the interaction was. The father, according to the family, tried to intervene to explain that Kenneth French had a mental disability. At some point, the officer went down on the ground and was out for a second or two. The attorney says out for 3 or 4 seconds at least. When he woke up, he felt under a threat, pulled his 9mm that he was carrying with him off duty and fired not just at Kenneth French, killing him, but critically wounding the father and mother as well.
Is there any indication of when we understand that there is surveillance video from the Costco? Is there any indication when that's going to become public?
No indication. The Corona police no doubt have possession of that now, and it'll be up to them when to release that video.
All right.
I have one other thing to say. May I? Do we have time?
Absolutely. Sure. Quick moment.
Yeah, quick moment on the first one. It's highly interesting what we heard from your two experts because one of them
and
was –
And we're talking now about – we're switching gears back to the 34 shots fired by the L.A. Sheriff's
Office. Exactly. I'm asking you, the listener, to remember what I said or what was being said 2 minutes ago.
Yes.
And so in the shooting in Willowbrook, the bunch of shots that killed Ryan Twyman, Obayashi is saying you should only consider exactly what happened in the moment the force was used. Cheryl Dorsey, the LAPD expert, is saying, no, you have to consider what happened ahead of that. And that is the debate in California that's going on right now. Should the actions of the officers ahead of a shooting, did they create the situation where they had to shoot? Did they contribute to the shooting? So should have those two deputies in this case held back, called for backup, surrounded the guy, and then taking him into custody as opposed to barreling in like they did.
Yeah, or using force, as Mr. Obayashi is saying, that in a split second, it's a reaction that is natural for a person in that situation to use. We have to cut the conversation short here, I'm afraid. I want to thank the two guests who've come in to offer their thoughts on these law enforcement-involved shootings. Ed Obayashi is a deputy sheriff and legal advisor for the Plumas County Sheriff's Office, and Cheryl Dorsey, a retired sergeant with the LAPD and KPCC's Frank Stoltz Public Safety Reporter for us. Thank you, all of you, for joining us for this conversation. Coming up, a quick conversation about the audit that came out recently about the Cal State University system potentially stashing away a whole bunch of cash. That story after a 1 minute break here on Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes on Air Talk. Coming up at half past the hour, we're going to be talking about the portrayals of gender stereotypes in advertising. An interesting conversation here about when those stereotypes can be harmful and when those stereotypes should or might be removed from advertising. But first, the state auditor's office this week had a harsh assessment of the Cal State University system's finances. Specifically, an audit says the Cal State system has stashed away more than $1.5 billion, all while increasing student tuition and lobbying state government for increased funding. But the university system has been pushing back on this audit, and joining me to discuss it is a reporter for the Sacramento Bee, Sosin Marar, who covers school accountability and has been following this story. Sosin Marar, thank you so much for joining us on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me.
So what is it that the state auditor says went wrong here?
Well, the state audit looked at two things. It looked at the CSU holding public funds outside the state treasury, and it also looked at the oversight and management of the parking program at various universities, including Sacramento State, Fullerton, and San Diego. And that's what they say went wrong. There's $1.5 billion stashed out in outside accounts in a reserve. And also, we've been putting money towards parking programs that the audit says did not improve parking at various college campuses.
Why did this audit happen in the first place? Maybe you can walk us through some of the backstory. I understand this was requested.
It was requested. So the California State University Employees Union requested Assemblymember Sharon Quirk Silva from Fullerton to conduct the audit. So this has been an ongoing process. State Auditor Elaine Howell presented this report yesterday, and we've been anticipating these findings for about a week now, knowing that it was quite a large sum of money in outside reserves.
Yeah. Now, the Cal State University system's response has been that these aren't exactly reserves. Can you walk us through that response? Like, what do they mean, this $1.5 billion of, discretionary, unrestricted money in these accounts isn't reserves?
Sure. So I spoke directly with Chancellor Timothy White of California State University, and he said there's a difference between using the word reserves and surplus, saying, surplus implies that this is money that's being stashed away. But, a reserve is what money that might be needed on a rainy day. So they said there are three reasons why California State University has these reserves. One, it was to cover any short-term obligations. This includes anything from, you know, debt, financial aid. Another is to cover maintenance that needs to be done on the 23 campuses. A couple of years ago, the state used to take care of these maintenances and facility upgrades, but now that burden is on the state universities. And the third was to offset any, you know, possible economic recession or any uncertainty that we might face in the coming year. So they said this money, you know, was really important. And they did call it kind of like a rainy day fund that they may need in the future.
So the Cal State University system has something like $27 billion, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that they get in student tuition. And you know, that's where a lot of their operating revenue comes from. I mean, so in that perspective, if you put $1.5 billion up against that, is that a lot of money, or is that? I mean, I guess there might be an argument that could be made that it's prudent that there's this kind of money lying around.
Sure, and that's a good argument. I think what was most telling with this and concerning for many finding out this audit report was that a lot of this money was coming from tuition, and we saw that tuition had increased over the years. You know, it's gone up to almost $6,000 in 2017, and so if this reserve money is coming from tuition, students are largely paying for it. And so are they seeing the money? Are they seeing the benefits of their tuition? Are they kind of seeing that return of investment? In particular, when we look at the parking program, I think if you ask any California State University a student who commutes to school, they struggle with parking. You know, here in Sacramento, they built, I believe, three new parking structures in the last, you know, decade or so, or more than that. And they are still complaining about parking. So the question is, yes, while there's a lot of money in the state universities, you know, where is it going and how are the students benefiting from that?
Yeah, one of the universities mentioned, by the way, that was dinged for building parking structures was Cal State Channel Islands in our listening area in Ventura County. So the question, I guess, going forward here, well, not going forward, the broader context, I mean, is that the UC system actually was dinged in a similar way in previous years over a smaller amount of money being held in reserves. I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about the context of that here.
Right. So that happened in 2017, and the UCs, they were dinged for $175 million. And while that made news and that made waves when we heard about the state audit report for California State University, it really trumps that number at $1.5 billion. So it kind of gives you – that really does give you a context of, you know, how much money this really is when University of California was putting away $175 million in outside reserves.
Do you have any sense of whether there's going to be a negative reaction that CSU is going to have to deal with here?
I would say that reaction has already started. I've seen a lot of, you know, just online comments. There are a lot of angry students, some saying that they already want their, you know, some type of compensation. But I think the question is just transparency. A lot of people in the state are really calling for all universities. These are public institutions. You know, where is the transparency? And I think moving forward, there will be a call for that in terms of, you know, showing where the funds are going, why there are reserves in the first place. You know, the chancellor's office says that there has been transparency. This isn't something that wasn't ever mentioned in their paperwork. They've made it clear that there are reserves. I think the concern here is highlighting that it was $1.5 billion.
Sosin Marar is a reporter for the Sacramento Bee covering school accountability, who's been following the story of a Cal State system audit by the state auditor's office, a finding this week that the Cal State University system has more than $1.5 billion stashed away, the university obviously disputing the characterization. Sosin Marar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back on Air Talk to talk about gender stereotypes. So there was this advertisement that ran on British television in 2012. This is a commercial for a UK grocery store chain called Asda. I'm just going to describe it for you briefly. Here we go. Picture a mom in a quick cut montage doing all the work of getting ready for Christmas. Mom baking, mom wrapping toys, mom decorating, and dad's trying to help too, of course, but it isn't going all that right because it's dad. And mom is licking a gajillion Christmas letters while also feeding formula to the toddler. Mom cooking Christmas dinner, and dad's grateful, but he's not helping too much. And finally, the final shot is Christmas night, contented family lying around next to the tree, cut to satisfied mom plunking down on a comfy chair with a glass of wine, and this closing line.
It doesn't just happen by magic. Behind every great Christmas, there's mom. And behind mom, there's Asda.
This ad might run afoul of some new restrictions on ads in Britain. Why? Because it portrays a harmful gender stereotype, a wife taking care of housework and chores without much help at all from her husband. A new rule from the UK's Advertising Standards Authority has banned harmful gender stereotypes in ads. Emphasis here on the word harmful. The guidance wouldn't end all gender stereotype portrayals, like women going shopping, men doing home repairs, but it does appear that context in the ads is really key. For example, a man or a woman failing to achieve a task specifically because of their gender, or an ad that belittles a man for carrying out a stereotypically female role or task. This new rule in Britain got us thinking about how many stereotypes we see in American ads. So I want to know from you whether you notice these stereotypes in the ads that you see on TV, on billboards, in magazine, or online. Do you think a ban on harmful gender stereotypes in American advertising would do us good? Or would such a ban short-circuit perfectly acceptable types of ads? Give us a call. Let us know your thoughts. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. I'm wondering if gender stereotypes in ads have ever made you second-guess yourself. And parents, I'm wondering if you've noticed that stereotypes in ads impact your kids, particularly as they relate to their gender. Joining us to discuss this is Chris Hackley, a professor and chair in marketing at Royal Holloway, one of the colleges in the University of London system. Professor Hackley, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
So the first thing I think we need to do is, for the benefit of our American audiences here, describe what the Advertising Standards Authority is in the UK. My understanding is that they're not government, but their rulings actually carry some force here. What type of authority does this agency have to enforce a new ban on harmful gender stereotypes?
Well, officially, the ASA runs a voluntary system of regulation. So if they decide that a particular ad has violated one of their codes of practice, then the ad agency and the advertiser should withdraw the ad if the ASA requests that. The truth is that they do have some pretty heavy sanctions if people do not conform to their requests. So, for example, they insist that the broadcaster themselves is responsible for withdrawing the ad. So the ad agency doesn't have an awful lot of choice in that if it wishes to advertise again with that broadcaster. So it is a system of voluntary self-regulation, but beneath the surface, there are some pretty tough sanctions for advertisers who don't comply.
For sort of American audiences here, to what extent does this mirror like government censorship? Does it have governmental force, these sanctions, or is it entirely self-enforced? Or are there like government rules that really give these rulings some force?
No, it's very much distanced from government regulation. And this was the whole point of organizing the ASA. It was felt that a government system of regulation would be too heavy-handed. And government can sometimes express opinions about advertising, and certain members of parliament sometimes in their speeches have done so. But they have no direct power. The Office of Communication, the government regulator, does regulate the whole of the communications industry, and they can enact legislation. But the actual business of day-to-day regulation of advertising is done essentially by the ASA and its partner agencies, such as BCAP, And the agencies, the ad agencies, and the broadcasters themselves.
I just want to make sure that we don't short circuit our conversation with American audiences about this, about whether this is going to be a First Amendment issue or anything like that. So thank you for clarifying that. With us also is Mara Einstein, a professor and chair of media studies at Queens College in New York, the author of Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. Professor Einstein, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So what kind of harms, since we're talking about banning gender stereotypes in ads, harmful gender stereotypes, what do you see as harmful about ads that create, that include these types of harmful gender stereotypes?
Well, I think this happens in a couple of different ways. I mean, some of the obvious things that occur is women being put in roles that are somehow demeaning, or that they are on screen in television commercials, but they don't say anything. And these are the kinds of things that those of us in media studies, as opposed to marketing, have been looking at for decades, particularly as it relates to television programming. So, right, so if a woman is in a scene and it's in a hospital, is a woman a doctor? If she is a doctor, does she actually have words to say, or is she just window dressing in the background? And so it seems to me what these regulations are trying to do is apply that kind of thinking to a communications mode or a sales mode. The issue becomes, and I think Chris would probably agree with me on this, is that commercials and advertising content is different than entertainment content in that you're trying to signal to people that you are trying to sell a product to a particular type of person. And you only have 30 seconds within which to be able to say that. And so if you're not showing a person that is immediately recognizable as someone doing something that the audience is going to understand, it becomes a much more difficult process to involve people into the sales message.
We're talking about harmful gender stereotypes in ads. We want to know if you've noticed these in advertising. Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. Parents, have you noticed your kids being impacted by the stereotypes, stereotypical portrayals of gender in advertising? Have gender stereotypes in ads ever made you second-guess yourself? Maybe a ban on harmful stereotypes would be helpful. Maybe not. Give us a call and your thoughts at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. We will be back with more of this conversation in just a few minutes, but first, a live news update with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. A new rule from the UK's Advertising Standards Authority has banned harmful gender stereotypes in ads. We spoke with the media and public affairs manager for this advertising authority. Her name is Shabnam Mustafa, and she notes that this change was announced back in December, so companies should be ready for it.
We've had a good couple of months to get used to what our new rules are going to be. So we've got buy-in from industry, and so we actually don't expect to see that many problem ads moving forward. However, if we do get a complaint about an ad where someone thinks it has broken our rules, we will look at it on a case-by-case basis. We will check if it's strayed beyond the line that we set, and we will have the power to ban it. And in nearly all cases, when we ban an advert, the advertiser will comply. And what we mean by compliance is they will either remove the ad completely or they will amend the ad so it does comply with our rules.
Now, the UK's new standards don't ban all gender stereotypes in ads, but it would ban gender stereotypes likely to, quote, cause harm or serious or widespread offense. We're wondering if you think that's a good idea and whether maybe we should have something like that in the United States. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page. Leave a comment at kpcc.org/airtalk. With me is Mara Einstein, a professor and chair of media studies at Queens College in New York. And I just want to bring it back to an ad that I described earlier. We played a short clip from it. It's the ad about there being a mom behind every perfect Christmas and depicting all of the work that she has to do. And yeah, maybe there's a schlubby dad involved. I guess I'm curious to know what the harm is from an ad like that. What's wrong with an ad like that?
Well, what it brought to mind when you were talking about that was this idea of the second shift, which is something that sociologists have been talking about for decades, which is this idea that moms go off to the workplace and work all day, and then they come home and they have this second shift where they're responsible for doing all the additional work in the household on top of everything they do in the office to bring home a paycheck. In the United States, this becomes particularly interesting because what is starting to happen now is that women are starting to earn more money than the men, but they're still responsible for this second shift. And so what seeing this in advertising does is it reifies this idea that women are supposed to be the ones who do all this extra work in the household while dad gets to come home, you know, kick off his shoes and have a beer. That's maybe where we were 50 years ago. It's certainly not where an idea that we should be perpetuating today.
Yeah. Chris, I'm wondering, Chris Hackley, I should say, professor and chair of marketing at Royal Holloway, one of the colleges in the University of London system. Chris, I'm wondering, you know, if you, like me, had a similar reaction when you watched that ad, or you can talk about your reactions to it as well, because I think there is the feeling like, well, what's wrong with showing how things, you know, sometimes actually play out, to Professor Einstein's point, that there are definitely shifts in gender roles, and perhaps it portrays an antiquated version for a lot of people of what family life looks like. But I guess I'm curious to know what your thoughts were about the harm that ad might have done.
Well, Mara's made me feel terrible now, Kyle, to be honest with you, because she just described my household. I feel quite conflicted about this because I have a 5-year-old daughter, and we take her to boxing, we take her to ballet, and she does piano, she does all that. I want her to do everything. I play football with her, you know, and so I can see where the worries are about gender stereotyping. But there are two particular problems that occur to me. One is that people talking about advertising is good for the advertising industry. One of the biggest problems the industry's had is persuading anybody that it worked. So what rules like this do is they play into the idea that advertising is a very powerful social force.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it is, it's also a platform for conflicts and debates to play out. The extent to which that connects with our real daily lives is very much open to question, I think, because, for example, in the UK, advertising is sometimes criticized as being too politically correct because it is more racially diverse than the population than the actual population. And so the advertising industry here is trying to respond to its role as a platform and an amplifier of such issues, and it has a social responsibility to do so. Whether that really is going to manifest in changes in everyday life, I have to admit I'm a little bit of a skeptic, because advertising is one thing, and when one looks around oneself, sadly, a lot of attitudes are very, very stubborn, and they're not necessarily changing.
Yeah. I want to let Mara Einstein, a professor and chair at Media Studies in Queen's College, maybe respond to that in a minute. But first, I want to read a few comments that we've gotten from Tom in Santa Monica. I think the UK system has it right. I don't think we should ban certain ads, but we should have people take more social responsibility. Self-governing is more effective and powerful. Stephen in San Gabriel, I interpret ads as simply selling a product, and I don't feel that they strongly influence me. The interesting question is, how do we define what exactly is a gender stereotype? There are many layers and subtleties to advertising. If you want to weigh in on the conversation, give us a call at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. I want to take a call from Yari in Laguna Niguel. Yari, you're on AirTalk.
Hey, yes. So I have noticed this kind of bias on advertising for many, many years now. And I think it's really about time you guys had this discussion. It's a great discussion to have. So what I've noticed is men have really been portrayed as comically incompetent in a lot of ads. And I really think that's harmful. Now, your guest said my advertising may not have that much of an effect, but I really think it does, and I think it's really important to have this discussion. if you don't want to portray a woman in a way that is controversial or stereotypical, I think we should be doing the same thing with men.
All right. Thank you, Yari, for the call from Laguna Niguel. Appreciate you weighing in on the conversation. If you've noticed gender stereotypes portrayed in advertising, give us a call at 866-893-KPCC. We're talking about new rules in the UK that would ban the portrayal of gender stereotypes. Have to take a quick break, then we'll come back, take more calls, and speak with our experts who've joined us to discuss this topic here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Talking about gender stereotypes in advertising, the UK has recently enacted a ban on portrayals of harmful gender stereotypes in advertising. It wouldn't prevent all gender stereotypes or gender roles from being portrayed, but those that are likely to cause harm or offense, for example, someone being unable to perform a task because of their gender. Mara Einstein, a professor and chair of media studies at Queen's College in New York, is with us to discuss this issue. And I wanted to bring back that caller that called in just before the break there, Mara. One of the things he noticed there is that, I agree that the woman in the ad and the role of the woman in the home, the second shift issue that you were describing, is certainly the more pernicious thing that is being played upon in that Christmas ad that we keep talking about a mom sort of being the key to a perfect Christmas. The other part of that ad that I noticed was that there was a dad who was behaving, you know, kind of like a doof the entire time. And it's certainly the more subtle part of the ad and certainly not the most pernicious part of the ad. But as the caller points out, is there a rise in the number of men who are portrayed in a deprecating way?
Yeah, and we see this not just in advertising. We see it in television programming, too. If any of your callers have young kids and they've seen parents being represented on networks like Nickelodeon, the parents always come off as being completely and utterly inept. Part of that is as a function of the advertising, because the advertiser is trying to sell you something. So they're trying to create a problem, and their product is going to come in as the hero and solve that problem. I think, to the caller's point, you know, whether this is something that could ever come to the United States, I think what's really important about it is it's getting people to think about it. Specifically, it's getting people in advertising to think about it, because advertisers don't want to cause offense, because the last thing they want to do is get into a situation where they have to placate their consumers because they've made them angry in some form or another. And they've thought about this in terms of race and social issues, and certainly we saw this with the Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad last year, when Pepsi sort of stepped in it by trying to co-opt the Black Lives Matter movement. And so agencies and advertisers have thought about it in terms of racial issues, but they have not thought about this in terms of gender issues. And I think that that's really important.
David in Woodland Hills called in to say advertisements are so much shorter than movies. Why is the focus on advertising and not on films that are so long and very violent? Reed in Thousand Oaks said, it's clear that advertising has a huge impact on how people think. I think it's great that the UK is doing it because it opens up that conversation about the impact of ads. Let's go to a caller, Vanessa in Highland Park. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. What's your comment?
That it's more just about gender and sexual identity and all of that. It's more about a moral issue. With the mental health on the rise and influenced by the media and suicide rate, not every child has a perfect home. Some are foster kids, some are residential, some are being raised by their grandparents, and some have two sick homes.
Yeah. Vanessa, I'm so sorry. We're having a little trouble with your line there on our end. What you had called in to say was that it's about mental health. It's about people who don't necessarily have the perfect portrayal of mental health, that there are so many homes that don't have two-parent homes, a mom and a dad. There's no representation of those can hurt is what the comment says here on my screen. But I'm curious to know, Chris Hackley, professor and chair in marketing at Royal Holloway, one of the colleges in the University University of London system. Maybe you can sort of touch on that issue here, that there's a deeper moral issue involved here about the portrayal of things not in always framed as part of an ideal.
I think advertising in the UK is pretty diverse. As I mentioned earlier, it is sometimes accused of being unrealistic to that extent. And the moral issue is that it's a big question whether advertising has a moral responsibility. And as one of your earlier callers said, it is quite a small platform in comparison to the airtime given to TV shows and movies and so forth. And what's more, it's shrinking. I mean, what we're talking about principally here is TV broadcast advertising. And as a proportion of all advertising, that's shrinking in the sense that the audiences for it are shrinking and going online. The ASA does have remit over online advertising, so it is intending for this ruling to cover all forms of media over which it has jurisdiction. But nonetheless, it is quite problematic to ask advertisers to take a moral position when they have other issues, they have other priorities, they have clients who need to sell stuff, So the problem is trading off their social responsibility with their commercial responsibilities.
Stephanie in Los Feliz, let's go to you. You've called in. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, I'm an actress in commercials. That's how I my primary source of income. So I paid a lot of attention to them and auditioned for many that didn't even make it to the air. Essentially, advertising is social propaganda. There's an ideal being represented. So when you, and representation matters. So when you see the female only portrayed as, you know, doing the housework, or for example, whenever I'm in a car with a male, I am never going to be driving the car. Mm. A lot of times if there's a comedic beat to the commercial, even though I'm a comedian, it's given to the male to say, and I kind of have the eye roll like this guy.
Yeah, you're playing the straight person, you know, the straight person in the comedic sense.
Exactly. So in a way, it's different than movies and television are telling specific stories. They can go to darker places. We really, in advertising, it's representing an ideal. And if you don't represent women working and men just, you know, taking care of the household as an okay ideal, you're not being representative of the possibility of different gender roles.
All right. Stephanie, thank you so much for calling in. Mara Einstein of the Queens College in New York, I want to give you the last word here. I'm curious to know whether you think we need regulations or whether the market is going to maybe solve this on its own here in the United States. I noticed a lot of portrayals of at least diverse families, you know, in a lot of advertising now, a certain increase in that, at least from my casual observation. Do we need regulations or some sort of self-regulating, you know, enforcement, or is this going to be created on its own?
I one of the things I was thinking when Chris talked about this in relationship was going on in the UK is it sounds to me like the industry is trying to regulate itself because it's trying to avoid regulation by the government, which is what oftentimes happens with these kinds of regulations. I don't think a legal recourse is the way to go with it. I think it's in terms of putting pressure on the industry. It's what's going to make it happen. But what's really important and something that Chris started mentioning and I think is really key is what we're talking about here is television commercials, and the vast majority of advertising, or not vast majority of advertising, but advertising is moving from television into the digital space, and that space becomes a very difficult place to regulate the advertising because there's just so much of it and it's all very personalized.
Mara Einstein is a professor and chair of media studies at Queens College in New York, the author of Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. And Chris Hackley is a professor and chair in marketing at Royal Holloway, one of the colleges in the University of London system. Thank you to both of you for joining us. Discussing gender stereotypes in the UK, new regulations, and a conversation with us about what American advertising standards should look like here on our Friday segment of Air Talk, which is produced produced by Matt D'Angelantonio, Natalie Chudnovsky, and Caitlin Plummer. Our news apprentices are Matt Bynum and Ari Saperstein. Our engineer is Parker McDaniels. And senior producer is Fiona Eng. Friends, these folks are the real pros that power AirTalk. They make guest hosting a pleasure. Thank you to all of you in the booth and to you, AirTalk listeners. It's been a real privilege. Thank you for listening this week. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle. Have a great weekend. Film Week is next.
Film Week, I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Today, for the next half hour, we'll be talking new movie releases. Later in the show, what was the most pivotal year for film? We'll be talking to Brian Raftery, who makes the case for 1999 in his new book, Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. Joining us this week are KPCC film critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, Wade Major, film critic for Cinegods.com, and Charles Solomon, critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Hello.
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 So, you guys, let's get started with the biggest release of the weekend. It's Toy Story 4, Pixar's continuation of the animated adventure comedy of Woody and Buzz Lightyear, as well as a new toy called Forky. I can't wait to hear about Forky. It stars Tom Hanks, Tim Allen, Annie Potts, and Tony Hale, directed by Josh Cooley, written by Andrew Stanton and Stephanie Folsom. Charles.
Well, the first three Toy Story features are something unique in not only in animation, but in American film. And during the course of them, you see not only computer animation advance, you see the artists and the characters deepen and mature and grow more complex in ways that really don't have a parallel. I think the only thing you can compare them to is the Lord of the Rings movies.
Hmm.
But unfortunately for me, and I realize I'm in the minority, this felt to me, to those films, what The Hobbit is to the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, that initially you are enrapt to be back in this magical world, to see the characters you know and love once again, who are beautifully animated, but I at least very quickly got the sense that things weren't tracking, that the characters weren't doing what they needed to. Beginning with Bonnie, who was this burst of energy and imagination and fantasy at daycare, is now afraid to go to kindergarten, which doesn't make much sense. She creates Forky on her first day, who is a spork with a pipe cleaner arms and little popsicle stick feet, but he doesn't think he's a toy, and what he keeps telling him that he is, and it's important to be as a toy, which is Buzz Lightyear from Toy Story 1 Redux. There is a nasty talking doll they encounter who's basically Lotso, but who instead of remaining nasty that made Lotso so strong and helped make that movie so dramatic, she gets this kind of Don Bluth sloppy redemption moment. You have Key and Peele doing the voices of two Carnival Prize plushies, and they sound like twin versions of the rabbit in The Secret Life of Pets. But the biggest problem for me was Woody, because for more than 20 years, through three features and specials and shorts, we've been told that, and Woody is the spokesman of this, that being played with by a child is a toy's career and raison d'etre. It's the only thing they exist for. In Toy Story 2, Woody gives up the chance to be preserved forever in perfection because he wouldn't be loved and played with. And now he's willing to toss this aside and become a lost toy, the thing that so terrified him in the first movie. And it just, I kept thinking, well, this isn't Woody. This isn't what he believes in. And why is he running off with Bo Peep, whom we haven't seen in many years? And I don't think really missed very much.
Wade.
I love this movie. And everything, and by the way, but let me underline, everything Charles says is correct. The first three Toy Story films are a triumvirate. They're a trilogy. They're a perfect, it closes a perfect circle.
Right, right.
Is this movie necessary? No, it's a completely unnecessary Toy Story film. At the same time, when I saw the first three Toy Story films, I was just a single film critic. I'm a father now. I have a 6-year-old daughter. And this is the first one that I've seen being a parent And I saw Bonnie have her struggles with kindergarten literally on the day that my daughter finished kindergarten. Hmm. So I was a sopping mess 10 minutes into this film because it was pushing so many buttons that I didn't have available to be pushed previously. It is a bit of a reboot for the characters. It does put them in situations and obligate them to do things and act out in ways that they otherwise would not, that are definitely out of character from what is established. If you can get past that, I think there are some wonderful, charming things in here, some great little Easter eggs as well that sort of reference other horror films and some very funny stuff if you're a film nerd. But it captivated me. I love the romance with Bo Peep. It pushed a lot of buttons and pulled a lot of levers that the other ones hadn't.
Amy, I want to give you a chance to chime in there.
Yeah, I guess I'm a toy without the buttons and levers that Wade has, because I'm going to side with Charles on this one. It just felt so absolutely unnecessary.
Unnecessary, yeah.
It felt like there was not enough plot here, that they were taking shortcuts to all the squishy hug moments.
It's too bad, because this is a series that really seems to have kind of taken its time in releasing films, and it didn't seem to be under pressure to just get a movie out there.
It's a different creative team this time, too. Charles can speak more to that. But yes, you definitely do not feel that it's the original writers who are working through a single narrative and creative vision, that it's a new team that kind of feels the need to sort of mark new territory.
And to Amy's point, the third Toy Story finished that story so beautifully.
And I agree.
I think you're exactly right. It feels unnecessary.
Well, I mean, for my money, I don't want to go back to the Toy Story universe unless it's a horror film about all of those, like, baby head spider leg toys in the Sid toy box universe. I want to go there.
Well, speaking of horror movies and toys, next up we have Child's Play, a remake of the 1988 horror classic. I don't know if I'd call it a classic, but okay, in which a mother gives her son a toy doll for his birthday, unaware of its sinister nature. The mother is played by Aubrey Plaza. The film also stars Gabriel Bateman, Brian Tyree Henry, and Mark Hamill as the voice of the doll. It's directed by Lars Klevberg and written by Taylor Burton Smith. Amy, please.
Well, first, just releasing a Child's Play movie on the same weekend as Toy Story is the most supreme act of trolling. And I really appreciate it. And their posters have even been making a deal of this, with images of Chucky's foot crushing a cowboy that kind of looks like Woody. And I have to say, I enjoyed this a lot. I'm sure you can make the argument there's no reason for a Child's Play movie to exist either. But toys have honestly changed a lot since 1988, when the first movie came out. And the new Chucky is connected to Alexa. Or an Alexa-type service, which means that this doll can now control everything in your house. That, I think, is kind of an intelligent way of making this movie feel relevant.
That's really interesting.
It is, and he also has a learned intelligence. He speaks back. We've made great toy advances.
So he's trying to make some sort of commentary?
It's taking a lot of nods from E.T., honestly. It has a little finger that glows when he's thinking about evil things. But basically, you know, the first Child's Play had this magical element where it was a serial killer who had put his soul inside a killer doll.
Right.
This one is actually more real world in that it gets started when a worker in Vietnam, a factory worker who's being abused at his factory, turns off all the safety controls because he's just so mad at his company. And so the doll learns violent behavior from the kids himself. I thought they made a lot of good reasons for this to exist.
Wait, please.
I'm not a fan of the original. I'm not terribly a fan of this one. Thank God for Mark Hamill, because his vocalization of Chucky is really the best thing about this film. It's really a lot of fun. For those who don't know, Mark Hamill has been voicing psychopaths for a number of years now.
He's the Joker, the animated voice.
And he also played the Puzzler on the original 90s Flash series, and he reprises the character. He's the only one who played the same character on the original and the current Flash series. He plays the Puzzler in both of them. Brilliantly, I should add. So he brings the psycho in a really great way. That said, I like the supernatural aspect of Chucky originally, that it's a possession story, as opposed to now where Chucky is Skynet and a really small Terminator, which is kind of what this is. The sadism that Mark Hamill brings to the character is what really makes it enjoyable. Otherwise, I did kind of feel like it was a little bit too much of a tech commentary. It's taken a stab at Alexa, taken a stab at Nest.
Taking literal stabs.
Literal stabs.
It's really, it's stabbing the whole smart home thing. You know,
Terrified of smart homes, so I'm very on board with this.
And see, I love the whole smart home thing, but it certainly does introduce a whole level of paranoia that it's a new paranoia that we have.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's exploiting that new paranoia, but I don't know that it's funny enough or scary enough to necessarily do it effectively. It's kind of caught between the two.
Well, Child's Play is the film. Aubrey Plaza and Gabriel Bateman star. Lars Klevberg is the director. It's rated R and it's playing in wide release. Next up, Wild Rose, a British musical drama written by Nicole Taylor and directed by Tom Harper. It stars the Irish actress and singer Jessie Buckley and also Julie Walters. Amy, and I should say this is the one film of the bunch I've also seen, so I might chime in here. Amy, can you set it up for us?
Yeah, A Wild Rose is a movie that we're going to, I think, be hearing a fair amount about for one major reason. That's the star, Jessie Buckley.
Mm-hmm.
What it is it's the story about a girl who gets released from prison in Glasgow, and she has grown up being a country singer at the Glasgow Grand Old Opry, which I Googled and is actually a place.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
So she's this country singer from Scotland, and she's a redheaded mess with two kids that she had when she was a teen. And
she's a bit like Courtney Love meets Patsy Cline almost, you know?
Exactly. Rampaging through Glasgow, making the worst decisions, wearing a ankle monitor under her white cowboy boots, and trying to figure out if she can have the career she wants in Nashville. And in a lot of ways, the story has kind of the familiar middle stretch of, is she going to make the right choice with her responsibilities, and everyone's lecturing her. I think most of the characters surrounding her in this film are a little bit phony, but Jessie Buckley herself is positioned to be, I believe, this year's breakout star. Mm. You know, she's in Chernobyl. She's going to be in the Judy Garland film. And she's an amazing redheaded rampager in this film.
I really liked some of the smaller performances, if you will. I thought the children came off really natural. And I thought her relationship with her mother in this film was very strong, too. And it's very much, when I look back on it, a film about female relationships, I thought. But wait, I want you to jump in there, too.
I really love this movie. Yeah. I loved it. And certainly most of it is because of her. Jessie Buckley is one of those towering presences who just takes over a movie and just owns it. And the movie winds up molding itself to her. And that's to the credit of the director, Tom Harper, who is, mm-hmm. you know, comes from British television and obviously has worked with a lot of great actors and recognizes that, you know, he's got a star in his midst. You know, use her. Let her energy dictate the pace, the rhythm, the feel of the film, the emotions of the film. And you also do have some great supporting performances in Julie Walters, who is just – she makes every movie that she's in better. She makes everyone else better. And Sophie Okonedo from Hotel Rwanda, who is so, so good here as well, as a woman that, you know, she works for, who enables her dreams to begin to materialize. This is very much a throwback to a certain kind of film from the 90s, a Miramax kind of a film. We, you know, Billy Elliot brassed off the full Monty. These working class mm-hmm. wish fulfillment British films where people just came from some really destitute working class industrial part of England with a dream, and somehow they make that dream real. And that really translated in the 90s in a very effective way. And there were probably about 6 or 7 of those movies, and then they kind of faded. And it's nice to have it back again, and especially with an actor who is so, so talented.
I agree. Well, I happened to speak with the star of the film, Jessie Buckley, earlier in the week on The Frame, and you'll be able to hear that interview at kpcc.org/theframe. We'll also have a link on the Film Week page. Again, Wild Rose, directed by Tom Harper. It's rated R and playing at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater. The next film is, hopefully I'll pronounce this right, Leta is a romance. You can help me with that, Amy. Is a romance from Russia about a love triangle that emerges around a rock and roll musician, his protege, and his wife in 1980s Russia. It's directed by Kirill Serebrennikov. Amy, what did you think?
Yeah, it's spelled like Jared Leto for people who are trying to Google it. This movie is, I think, an incredibly imaginative film. What it is it's a story about a group of two competing punk rock singers.
Love it.
In 1980s Leningrad, at a time when they're trying to make the case for why punk rock is allowed to be on Russian TV. You know, they come up with things like the Sex Pistols are simple working men in trying to defend these artists that they love who are considered, you know, ideological enemies by the state. The characters themselves are, you know, kids who kind of just want to be famous, kind of want to rebel. They're trying to figure out really what their place is. They're not necessarily like absolute heroes. And it's the mistakes they make as they're sort of bumbling around, competing with each other, being image conscious, that you kind of are really drawn to. But where this film really takes off, despite a love triangle thing that takes up a lot of space in it, is when they do musical numbers within this film. You know, it's beautiful black and white cinematography, by the way. And there are moments when they perform, like, say, an Iggy Pop song on a bus, or they call the band The Heads That Talk. They do a number by them on a train. And this, the director just absolutely lets the screen get scribbled on, punk rock energy. And the Russian characters around them, the simple other men and women on the bus or on the train, sing the lyrics along. And you realize, like, to grow up in Russian society in this moment means you are a little bit punk rock on the inside, even if you don't think you are.
And how is the music, by the way?
I mean, it's great. It's terrific. I love this sort of music. Yeah. So I'm...
It's worth noting, too, the director, Cyril Brennikoff, is a severe Putin critic and has been under house arrest recently, too, and is facing all kinds of other legal problems, largely as a result of being so outspoken and being a punk himself.
Let's come back to Leto after the break. Coming up, we'll continue with our conversation about Leto and review the German drama In the Isles, also a documentary about the writer Toni Morrison. Later in the show, we'll talk to the author of a new book that makes the case that 1999 was the best year ever for movies after this short one-minute break. You're listening to Film Week. Welcome back to the show. I'm Stephen Cuevas, and we're joined by our critics Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. When we left off, we were talking about the Russian film Leto. Wade, I wanted to let you continue your comments.
I kind of respect the film probably more than I like it. It is beautifully made. I mean, there's no question about it. The directing and the imagination that went into it and the cinematography is superb. It doesn't really – and I believe it's based on true characters. Amy, am I correct that the two male leads were actually figures in the scene.
Oh, I'm not sure. I didn't know that.
I believe that's the case. Regardless, it's kind of meandering, and it's over 2 hours long. And at a certain point, I felt like I was just kind of touring with the band. And not really watching a movie, which I guess for some people is probably a fun thing. But at a certain point, it does feel like it's just drawing itself out, going bouncing from one musical number to another and not really kind of pushing any kind of a firm narrative.
Well, I still think I'm going to check it out. So next up, True Justice, Bryan Stevenson's Fight for Equality. It's a documentary directed by George Coonhart, Peter W. Coonhart, and Teddy Coonhart. George and Teddy are brothers. Peter is their dad. It's a look at how Alabama attorney Bryan Stevenson struggles to create more fairness in the legal system. Charles.
Well, Bryan is a lawyer who should be more of a household name than he is probably. He believes that equal justice under the law, which is inscribed in the portico of the Supreme Court, should actually be a fact as well as a philosophy. Mm. He's successfully argued 5 cases at the court, including a recent one that succeeded in eliminating the death penalty for defendants who are mentally impaired, that someone who has limited facilities should not be killed by the state. He's also one of the forces behind the creation of the museum in Alabama that has the monument to lynching victims that I believe opened it was either earlier this year or late last year. So he's this highly admirable and in some ways even heroic figure. Some of the most moving footage is with a man who spent 30 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. And Stevenson spent untold hours and years trying to get his case reexamined. And the defendant, who is now finally out and free, as he should always have been, notes that an attorney general or assistant attorney general who Stevenson tried to get to examine the forensic evidence that Stevenson and his team had uncovered that proved he was innocent, the attorney general refused and was subsequently awarded a federal judgeship by George W. Bush. It's about his current passion is to try and end mass incarceration, to see that fewer people of color are in the prison system where they're so disproportionately consigned. It's a very stirring movie, a little long maybe, but you end up with enormous admiration for this man who is sincerely committed to the idea of justice and equality under the law and trying to make it a reality.
Well, the film is True Justice, Bryan Stevenson's, I'll get it right, Fight for Equality. It's a documentary directed by George Peter and Teddy Coonhart. It's unrated. You can watch it at the Lemley Glendale, and it'll be streaming starting Wednesday, June 26th on HBO. Next up for review, we have the German drama In the Isles, about a man who gets a new job in a supermarket, falls in love with his married coworker. It's directed by Thomas Stuber, who also wrote the film with Clemens Meyer. Amy, what you think?
Yeah, the plot might sound kind of adorable, but this film has ambitions to be like the 2001 A Space Odyssey of being in a giant grocery store in Germany.
Now.
I mean that. There's like epic scenes of classical music as forklifts move up and down the beverage aisle. And it has this really lovely tedium that ended up really sucking me in. I mean, this is a film about a guy with a bunch of tattoos who shows up after kind of a shady past to start working in the beverage department. And it's a very deliberately cloistered film. There's almost no sunlight. You're trapped inside here with these people over the course of months as he falls in love with Sandra Hüller, who people might know from Tony Erdmann. She plays his love interest, who he calls Miss Sweet Goods. And this is a film that I found like really worked on me. I see Wade rolling his eyes already.
Yeah.
It's
okay,
gonna be
Wade,
this kind
you'll
of
get
week,
your chance.
But
yeah.
I was shocked by how much I got invested in the world of learning how to use a forklift. There's forklift wars between departments. There's gory forklifting training videos that are amazing. There's a moment where a character says, "You're forklifting like a maniac because you're in love." I think this film is really, really surprising and worth
watching. There are departments that feud over forklifts.
In the film.
Yeah. You know, there's almost a hierarchy of forklifts.
There
you know,
is. So, yeah. I've worked in warehouses, and there is.
Yeah, it's a forklift caste system. Yeah, this is like a longer, less funny version of Punch Drunk Love in German with lots of forklifts. And I would just rather watch Punch Drunk Love.
I would not.
Which I adore, but it, for that kind of a quirky romance. I mean, it has its moments. It's too long. It's over 2 hours. It doesn't justify the length. Maybe if this were a 95-minute movie, and again, I'm half German, so I can say this, we're not funny people. So,
I don't think it's supposed to be that funny. I think it's supposed to be
like
soul-sucking and lovely and oppressive.
In that case, it works. That's what
then
we are.
Then it works. Thank
that's
you for agreeing with me. I will treasure this moment.
It sounds like it's that deadpan kind of funny, that Jim Jarmusch kind of funny. Anyway, the film is the German drama In the Isles. It's directed by Thomas Stuber. It's playing at Lemley's Royal Theater, and it's unrated. Next up, a documentary, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. It's directed by Timothy Greenfield Sanders, and it examines the life and the themes of the famed author. It features interviews with Oprah Winfrey, Angela Davis, and other notable figures who were influenced by Morrison's writing. What do you think, Charles?
Well, as long as this is Toni Morrison talking, or Angela Davis, or Oprah Winfrey, or Hilton Ahls, I'm blanking on her name. it will come to me. Another woman writer I'm very fond of. It's so entertaining. It's so interesting. Morrison is unabashedly intelligent in an era of sound bites and tweets and dumbing things down. She makes no compromises about her own erudition and ability to put words together, that her themes are serious. Her thoughts are interesting. She's entertaining, whether she's talking about how she approached the very difficult subject of the beloved or her apparently extraordinary recipe for carrot cake, which she apparently makes one of the best carrot cakes there is. I think the film falters because, one, it's too long, and two, they don't seem to trust their subject. If Toni Morrison begins to talk about the roles African-American women have had in this country, things that have been assigned to them and forced on them and that they've had to endure, they suddenly cut to old pictures of sharecroppers or, women in the pre-civil rights days. And you don't need those. Morrison is so eloquent. Just let her talk and she takes us where we need to go.
Right. Wade.
I think I like it better than Charles, but his points are really spot on. There is a feeling that you're working with documentarians who feel as though they need to sort of shoehorn this into a template. Mm-hmm. And Toni Morrison defies a template. She sort of is one of those rare authors who broke the template. And her editor points that out. This is her lifelong editor, who was her colleague originally when she was an editor.
Yeah, Robert Gottlieb. Who I worked with on a book.
Yeah, and he points that out, that she has this amazing intuition about structure, and that she really is able to do things acrobatically with words that defy description, which is what makes her writing so engaging. And where I really responded to the film was sort of in spite of its constraints, which is that when she is telling you things that I didn't know about her life, which is she grew up in a very integrated community and didn't really experience segregation until she went to college, to a predominantly black college, where now skin tone is how they're self-segregating, and that was such this bizarre experience to her. And how she integrates that lesson into her work, and then hearing her talk about being an editor and how she segregates, to use the word very ironically here, between being an editor and being an author, and how she's able to distinguish between those two jobs and how they also cross-pollinate in her work. Those insights into her process and into her worldview are fascinating and yes, really engaging. The film doesn't do it any favors by doing what Charles says, by sort of not trusting its subject enough, but she is a strong enough presence that it comes through and makes it worth seeing just the same.
Right, great.
Well, it's also fascinating. They show some of her manuscripts that she writes in
pencil. I wish we had seen more.
Exactly.
I wanted to see more, yeah.
And you see her writing
things down. More of the actual process.
Yeah, and words crossed out and new ones put in. Yeah. And they also show how she did that, helping Angela Davis to edit her memoir. And you want more of that and less of those old photos and stock footage.
I agree.
Well, the film is Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, and it's directed by Timothy Greenfield Sanders. It's rated PG-13. You can find it at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater. Next up, an Australian comedy. It's called Ladies in Black, adapted from the novel The Women in Black. This film follows the lives of a group of department store employees in 1959 Sydney, directed by Bruce Beresford, who also wrote the film with Sue Milliken. What you think, Wade?
I love this film. I absolutely unabashedly love it, and I think it is a disgrace how Sony is handling this film. Stage 6 is a subsidiary of Sony. This film was released digitally even back in March, and it's getting something of a token release right now. I would urge everyone, please find this in a theater and show Sony that you want to see this in a theater. This is Bruce Beresford, who directed an Academy Award-winning Best Picture, who directed Breaker Morant, one of our most distinguished directors and one of the most distinguished directors in the history of Australia. This is a film he tried to get made for 30 years. For 30 years, he's been trying to get this film made, finally got it made, based on a novel by a woman that he went to school with and who passed in 2006, and he had promised her for years that he would try to get it made. It takes place in 1959 in Sydney, and it centers around a bunch of women who work at a department store who all wear black. That's what it means, ladies in black. That's their department store uniform. But each of them has a completely different life challenge, and it goes into their families and their upbringings, and one of them, played by Julia Ormond, is an immigrant from Slovenia. It deals with immigration, the relationship between native-born Australians and immigrants at that time. It's a wonderful pastoral, poetic, and melodramatic, and oftentimes really funny and very touching portrait of 1959 Sydney. And it is so beautifully made.
The film is the comedy-drama Ladies in Black. It's directed by Bruce Beresford, and it's playing at Lamley's Music Hall. It's rated PG. And I wanted to squeeze this one in before the break, a film called The Command. It's an action-drama based on the story of the 2000 Kursk submarine disaster, directed by Thomas Vinterberg and written by Robert Rodat. It stars Matthias Schoenaerts and Leah Seydoux and Colin Firth. Wade, do you want to set this one up?
Yeah, I remember this exactly. I love submarine movies. I can't get enough of submarine movies. And Vinterberg just kills this. He really does. He nails it. Logistically, this is an amazingly challenging piece of filmmaking. You're dealing with a sinking submarine. You're dealing with a lot of different story threads, including the British, who have this, you've got Colin Firth running the British and coming to the rescue. It's all in English, which is a little bit odd, but it's trying to win back its $40 million budget by catering to an English language audience, and I hope that it does. It is really riveting. It's adapted from the nonfiction book that details the entire incident. I think it does a very good job of dramatizing the whole affair.
Amy.
I was much less compelled by this film. I really was. I mean, it opens in a way where you're thinking, oh, this film wants to be the next Deer Hunter. Okay, I'm in. Let's see what happens. And from there, I mean, to me, I guess I don't really dig submarine films. You get in there, you're claustrophobic. It's a lot of men mumbling. But speaking of Putin, he was supposed to be in this movie for five scenes, and they cut him out in order to make it less political.
Yeah.
Yeah, short break, and we'll be back with more of Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week. Welcome back to the show. I'm Stephen Cuevas, here with our critics Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Well, the year was 1999. There was end-of-the-world-level panic over Y2K. There was impeachment proceedings brought against President Bill Clinton. While kids, they were obsessed with stuff like Pokemon cards and MTV's TRL with Carson Daly. While at the cinema, it seemed to reflect all of it. The movies of 1999 kind of reflected the anxiety and the goofiness of the time. If the world was going to end, we were sure ending it with some pretty dynamite movies and some of the most quotable of all time.
The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club.
And don't forget, I'm also just a girl standing in front of a boy, asking him to love her.
I see dead people.
Oh my God. Fight Club, Notting Hill, and The Sixth Sense, just a few of the many movies that came out in the year 1999. And here to make the case for why it was arguably the greatest year in film is Brian Raftery, author of the new book, Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. Welcome, Brian. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
And we're all going to gang up on you here in this segment.
That's fine.
The four of us.
a room full of very opinionated movie lovers is my dream.
Yeah, you may not leave alive. We're not sure. So the title of your book makes a pretty bold statement that 1999 is pretty much the best year ever for movies. Tell us how, in terms of impact, in terms of quality. How about?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, one is that, you know, there's a term in the industry when they're testing movies looking for a four-quadrant film, which is they want something that will appeal to every demographic and age and gender. And I sort of think of 1999 as a sort of a four-quadrant year. You had this really remarkable range of movies. You had these big spectacles like The Matrix. You had these very grown-up, very interesting movies about us as a society like Boys Don't Cry or The Insider. You had these great romantic comedies. I mean, Notting Hill was in that intro. There was also The Best Man. And you also just had these movies that sort of felt like they would never have gotten made any other time. I mean, I can't think of Being John Malkovich coming out in any other year than this year. We were all sort of thinking about identity and the end of the world, and we'd had years and years of experimental filmmaking to kind of build up on it. And I also think it's a great year because it's building on all the other great years. If you talk to the filmmakers of that year, whether it's Sam Mendes or Kimberly Pierce or Steven Soderbergh, they were drawing so much on the films of the 40s and the 70s and even the 90s and everything in between. And it was an art form that was about at the 100-year mark. And this was this really interesting culmination of all these great filmmakers, from Kubrick to Spike Jonze to Alexander Payne to Malcolm Lee, getting to make these movies they really wanted to make.
You know, at the time, there was that anxiety about Y2K, but I remember it also being just kind of silly that we all kind of knew, like, oh, it's nothing's going to really happen. It's almost like we wanted to scare ourselves. And I wonder, like, well, that's kind of the same with movies. We go to the movies because we want to get scared, you know?
Well, it was a big deadline. And I mean, we all do kind of laugh about Y2K now, but when you go back and look at some of the articles, like whether it's the cover of Time or the cover of Newsweek, I mean, this was a very big concern. And people, whether or not they were really specifically worried about whether, you know, the photocopier was going to eat them at midnight or something like that when the clock struck 12, like, This was a big change. None of us had ever gone through a big century change before, and who knew what that meant. And we also had the last couple of years of the internet, which was this very altering, kind of a mind-altering substance we were all just starting to learn how to work. Yeah. And I think that caused some anxiety, too. Like, where are we going? And this is a very big deadline. And are computers our friend, or are they going to kill us all in the end, you know?
Well, Wade, you were writing about film in 1999?
Yes, I was,
unfortunately. I mean, as you were you know, going to the cinema and watching these movies come out, did it feel like a special year to you?
It did. The 90s were really solid. Things didn't really start to tank until the 2000s, to be honest, for the quality of films. I think that's when things really took a dive. But the 90s were a good time. You know, I started going to festivals in the early 90s. And by the time we got to the late 90s, you really felt like independent film in particular was hitting its stride. You know, Miramax and Sony Classics and October. And there were a lot of independent distributors at that time that were really very very flush with cash. Festivals were doing very well. So a lot of a really interesting mix of films were getting made because they could get distribution. And those distributors were doing well because they could promote those films to an audience.
Charles, you were also writing about film at the time.
Well,
going
yes,
to the
for my high school paper.
Yes, of course. I know. All right.
No, 99 was, as I've often said, the year we needed the Oscar category for animated feature.
Yeah.
That was Disney's Tarzan that brought out their deep canvas way of creating backgrounds and dimensional backgrounds with gorgeous animation. Toy Story 2 that proved to us that CG can make people cry, which it
had
never done before.
And you told me Toy Story 2 not originally meant to be shown in theaters, right?
It started as a direct-to-video sequel, and then they looked at it and said, no, we can't have two standards of quality at Pixar. This has to be as good as the first film or we won't make it. And so they went back to work on it, and in 18 months, completely remade that film. That was also the year Princess Mononoke, the first of Miyazaki's films, to get a widespread release in this country, and the first time I met him and interviewed him. And it was the year of The Iron Giant, one
Fantastic.
Of the most beloved of all American animated films that was so shabbily handled by Warner Brothers. Few people got to see it, but it still lives on in everyone's hearts. And
yeah.
Really established Brad Bird as the formidable talent that
written,
he is.
Written or based on the book by Ted Hughes, the
mm-hmm.
poet
yeah.
Ted
yeah.
Hughes, who, if I understand right, wrote the book after his wife's, the poet Sylvia Plath, mm-hmm. committed
yeah.
suicide as
yeah.
a way to sort of channel his grief. Amy, you were, I think, allowed in R-rated films in by 1999 at least, so you were going to the cinema.
Was I?
You,
yes. You know, Wade mentioned the C-word cash, which I think is the really important one here. You know, because to me, what really strikes me as important about 1999 is that DVD sales had just started a few years ago.
That's right.
And the studio system was getting influxed with all of this cash. And they were willing to use that cash to make gambles. You know, we talk a lot about the early 90s as like the rise of the Sundance indie era. What the studios did in 99 is they thought, you know what? If we make a really good film, they're going to buy a ticket in the theater, and then they're going to buy it on DVD. And they were willing to take their money and spend it on people who had already made a couple films coming up, people like Paul Thomas Anderson, David O. Russell, or they were willing to invest in a music video director like Spike Jonze and say, here, have multi-millions of dollars and make something creative, make something with personality. And they immediately now got too afraid to do that. That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, now if you make a great Sundance film, they're going to say, have a Star Wars. Mm. But they're not going to say, be creative, make something new, make a story that's going to last for 20 years.
Well, the indies died around 2007, you know. So 99 was kind of a peak moment. It was they started in the early 90s. They peaked around 2000 about 1999, 2000, and that's when the corporation started to pull the plugs on them, and 7 years later they were dead.
Right.
Yeah,
I
wanted to agree with Amy that it was home video that really was fueling things. When I spoke to one Disney executive about making the first Toy Story and said computer animation had never been used for more than a couple of minutes before. Mm. Wasn't this a gamble? And he said, for $20 million, who cared?
Right. So, Brian, it wasn't just the fact that you had some great directors, some great artists out there making great films. There was the infrastructure, the business that was supporting it as well.
Yeah, and you had the executives who were supporting it. I mean, I think I talked to like 130 people for the book, from filmmakers to really big executives. And when you talk to them, I mean, these were all not just the filmmakers who sort of come up on the 70s, but the executives did too. And they felt an obligation to take risks. It was part of the job. And I mean, certainly you look at what Warner Brothers did that year with The Matrix or with Three Kings, where, you know, they're going to take David O. Russell, who, as Amy said, had made a couple small indie movies at that point, give him something like $50 million, put him in the desert with George Clooney and make a movie about the Persian Gulf War.
And Ice Cube.
Right? Yeah, and Ice Cube and Mark Wahlberg and Spike Jonze and like basically his first big acting role, who, you know, they had to kind of fight to get him in the movie. And it's like, you don't get those kind of movies unless these executives are pretty brave and also willing to kind of put their necks on the line and say, no, this is going to be a really important, interesting movie and we should make this.
I really love that movie too.
Three Kings is great.
I want to go around and ask you all to tell me one film you really, really love from 1999, and we'll do so after the break. But just give us a tease, Brian. What's one film that you would, you know, kind of take to the desert, the island with you?
I would probably pick Flick. That's my hint of the Reese Witherspoon, Matthew Broderick Election, which I love that movie. I could watch Election a million times. It never ages to me. I find something new. I find a new character to relate to every time I watch it, which is weird.
I'm here with Brian Raftery, author of the new book, Best Movie Year Ever, as well as KPCC's critics Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. We'll be back right after this short break. You're listening to Film Week. I'm Stephen Cuevas here with our critics Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon, and also Brian Raftery, author of the new book Best Movie Year Ever: How 1999 blew up the Big Screen. So before the break, Brian, you were telling us that Election was like the one standout film for you. I want to do a quick round robin. Charles, you mentioned Iron Giant. Is that the one you would take away from 1999?
How do you pick among Iron Giant, Toy Story 2, and Princess Mononoke? So I'm going to be greedy and claim 3 because I think each one is extraordinary in its own way.
And stylistically, so different as well.
Yeah.
Amy.
I mean, if we're going to be greedy, I'm going to say Magnolia, Cruel Intentions, my deep, dark, dark secret, and The Blair Witch Project as a film that I just that I find so influential and like really blowing up the tiny indie horror market into being a big deal. I don't think we'd have Blumhouse if we didn't have Blair Witch. And if we didn't have Blumhouse, we wouldn't have most of the new horror stuff that's happening today.
And how many people have copied that pseudo found footage format since then?
Exactly. And I think because of all the copiers, the Blair Witch Project got a bad name, but that film is still terrific. Oh, and I have to say, being John Malkovich, because I am the biggest Charlie Kaufman fan in the world.
Yeah,
as Charles knows.
And just the story behind Blair Witch is fascinating into itself. Wasn't there a documentary made? It was also like a fake documentary about.
What's amazing is, as of at least 2 years ago, they still had the original website up for the Blair Witch Project because, as Brian mentioned, you know, the internet is starting. We're getting crazy. And you can still find these fake short documentaries they made with the townsfolk around Blair Witch on the internet now, and they still look really realistic. And this perfect storm of people thinking what was on the internet was true, fancy that, and then using it to make a movie work. It was amazing. I felt like that really was a glimpse of the future.
Yeah. Wait. I still love that movie. It's so scary.
I can't think of anything more extraordinary than taking a 60-minute story and turning it into one of the great films of the last quarter century in The Insider. The perfect marriage of talent
Russell
and
Crow,
material.
Right?
Russell Crowe. Mm-hmm. Michael Mann has never made a better film. It's just the perfect marriage of director and script and cast, and everything just came together. If I can be greedy, I would also throw in, and correct me unless I'm wrong, I'd like to throw in The Red Violin because it was released in 99. It's a 98 film. It premiered at the 98 Toronto
Film
Festival.
Remind us the story of The Red Violin.
It's an omnibus film about a violin as it passes through a number of hands over the years,
yes,
and it's centered around all cross-cut in the current day auction with Sam Jackson trying to take possession of it. An amazing movie, amazing film.
Yeah. One movie I wanted to mention was a real standout, and that's Straight Story, a movie that's probably the most un-Lynchian of any David Lynch film. It's rated G for one. Based on a true story, it tells the story of this elderly man, Alvin Straight, who drives some 250 or 300 miles on a John Deere tractor to see his ailing brother who just had a stroke. The brother's played by Harry Dean Stanton. It's very moving. Brian, you and I were talking about it before we started.
Yeah, it's very moving. And, you know, it's also – it wasn't produced by Disney, but it was released by Disney. And when you mentioned The Insider, those are the Disney movies – some of the Disney movies in 1999. I mean, if you think of a movie that's a risk, The Insider is, well, here's a big-budget movie about the tobacco industry. It's going to be rated R. No chance for a sequel. It's going to be about 2.5 hours, and it's going to be based on – it's going to be a very anti-corporate film that's going to be for people who don't know anything about the news industry or the tobacco industry. It's going to require a lot of hand-holding to get them through this. And it's a remarkable film. And what studio would greenlight that in 2019? You can't franchise a true life story
And
like
with
that.
Straight Story, I think a lot of people ignored it maybe because once they – understood what the plot was about. It's like, well, I don't want to see that from David Lynch.
But it's very, you know, it's also, I think people now, they would see the log line for that and go, oh, this is going to be depressing. But that's a really remarkably moving film. And I think, you know, Amy mentioned Magnolia, and there were a lot of films that year that were about family and troubled families. I mean, American Beauty, which is the very other on the opposite end of that kind of dramatic spectrum, is this, which won Best Picture for that year. But certainly there was a lot of grappling with the people around you in your life. And these movies, you walked out feeling really kind of shell-shocked by what they were trying to tell you and what they were sort of opening you up to the world around you. And they're just very personal feeling films.
And you were able to interview Mary Sweeney, who is the screenwriter.
Yeah, yeah.
Straight Story.
Yeah, she's great. I mean, and it is funny too, because it is a very un-Lynchian film, but I watched it two or three times, and there's just little moments in there where there's just like a little odd sound effect, or like there's this little shot that you're like, oh yeah, this is a David Lynch movie.
Like little awkward moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a lovely film. Yeah.
Yeah. You talked to Mary Sweeney. So what were her reflections about 1999 as a year of film?
I think, you know, when you talk to almost all the filmmakers from that year, I think one of the reasons why they were so eager to sort of talk for the book, which really frankly surprised me because these are very busy people, and a lot of them are making TV now, which is interesting, which is kind of a strange switch from over 20 years ago, is that I think a lot of the filmmakers that year realized that they were kind of getting a chance to do whatever they wanted. And now 20 years later, it's much harder to do that. It's very hard to sort of go, hey, here's a movie about a guy in a tractor. It's going to be it's David Lynch. You can't really put a really cool song on it. You can't franchise it, but here you go. And Disney released it, and it, you know, became an Oscar contender, and Richard Farnsworth got nominated. And
yeah.
I don't know what that movie would be in the culture in 2019. It might be a quiet little Netflix movie that someone emails you a recommendation for, and you never get a chance to watch, you know?
Wade, I think you wanted to chime in there on Straight Story?
Oh, no, well, I lived through Straight Story because my wife worked on the film. So
What?
She was controller for Mary Sweeney and David Lynch's company at the time. So I was exposed to all of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and it was the story of the making of the film is every bit as amazing as the making of the film itself.
Yeah, that's also true of Iron Giant, which I had a similar experience with.
Yeah, it was you know, when you finally see the film come together and you know the whole cross-country odyssey behind it, it was quite a thing.
Right. The main character played by Richard Farnsworth was quite sick at the time of the filming.
Yeah.
Right. And sadly committed suicide a couple of years after the film.
But he got an Oscar nomination out of it, which was the capper for his career. Didn't win, but I didn't need to. You know, Farnsworth was a fixture all the way back to The Natural.
Stuntman.
Stuntman originally. And, you know, that was the cherry on top of a really amazing career.
Well, speaking of Oscars, it goes to American Beauty in 1999, which, I don't know, looking back and you see the types of films that are nominated or that win the Oscar, and it's quite dark in many places. It goes into some pretty rough and controversial territory. You know, how does that film, do you think, how does it stand up?
You know, it's a really interesting movie because to write about and think about, because as I was reporting the book, the Kevin Spacey stuff happened. And so that kind of changed for some people immediately when I would talk about the movies, when I was interviewing people and mentioning the movies, and I'd say American Beauty, and they go, ooh, wait, yeah, that's kind of a tough one now. And, you know, I was not an American Beauty fan when it came out. I was very much pro, like, election should be Best Picture, and being John Malkovich should be nominated Best Picture, and The Insider, which was nominated, maybe even be my Best Picture of those nominees. But there is something that's aged kind of well about it. I mean, the whole idea of, at the time, I was like, what is this movie about? A bunch of a neo-Nazi lives in the suburbs, and I'm like, and Kevin Spacey's playing this kind of leering creep. That doesn't seem very on. Now I'm like, ooh, that movie was a little bit more ahead of its time than I realized at that time, you know?
So could we have a year like 1999 again now in the near future?
You know, it's funny because a lot of stuff that's been happening, this is a very weird summer and year, as everyone's talked about on this show, about these franchises seem to be in trouble and the studios kind of don't know what they're doing. And when I talked to a lot of the executives of the late 90s, that's kind of what they were seeing in 96, 97 with all these unnecessary sequels. I mean, like, of all the 90s movies we've all forgotten about, The Odd Couple 2 is the one that you look at and you go, why was this made? And what happened was...
The Flintstones 2.
The Flintstones, Viva Rock Vegas, yeah. And I don't know why I know that title. But I think it could happen again if we get that kind of energy and sort of new ideas and the studios take some risks like they did back in the late
90s. I sure hope so. Yeah. Well, my thanks to KPCC film critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, Wade Major, film critic for Synagogues.com, and Charles Solomon, critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. And thanks to Brian Raftery, author of the new book, Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. I'm Stephen Cuevas from all of us at Film Week. Have a great weekend.